Welcome to another episode of A World of Good podcast. I'm your host, Andrew Gale, here with my good friend, Joshua Wieger, as we're recording some intro episodes for these reflection episodes for season 9. Josh, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, so glad to be here. And thanks so much for engaging this stuff, Andrew. This is so helpful to me in my own walk, but also in the work that we're doing.
Thanks. I had that written out for you to say so that you could say exactly that. I wanted to make sure you said thank you to me in this. No, just kidding. Great to have you here. We're nearing the end of season 9 as we've kind of gone through some of these reflection episodes, some new episodes, hearing from the church and being reminded of all the good that God's doing around the world. If you want to connect with us, you can go to A World of Good Podcast. We're on Twitter at A World of Good Pod, and Instagram, just search for A World of Good Podcast. We certainly love hearing from you. Today, we're sharing again some content from the past, an earlier episode that we just think is worth hearing again. The conversation we're doing today is actually from season 3, so another earlier episode from aired March of 2021. That we did with Allie Hawkins. It was part of a series on millennials and missions. And so excited for you to hear this conversation again with Allie Hawkins about the way that millennials are engaging with missions around the world.
Andrew, I have a confession. I don't remember this episode at all.
Well, then you're going to have so much fun re-listening to it.
I am excited about it, actually. Even the topic is very engaging to me.
So Allie is a missions kid. Her parents were missionaries for the Church of God in Kenya. But then she has gone on to do some incredible research with Barna and wrote this incredible piece about missions today and specifically focusing on millennials and missions engagement and missions towards the future. And so we had her come and join us. A lot of this is talking about kind of grappling with the history of missions, and it relates to us as an organization, how we understand, honor, and learn from our past while continuing to move forward.
Andrew, what generation are you?
Well, it depends. I'm a millennial. I consider myself a millennial.
Okay. For someone who's not a millennial, why should they listen to this? Why is this important?
Yeah. So I think because the world is changing and missions is changing as different... different demographics of people come into leadership, the way that group of people, that generation thinks about missions and the church and the work that the church is doing is different. Mm-hmm. And so this gives a great perspective of what some young people think about missions. Mm-hmm. And then how do we engage them in doing this work? Because there's still a lot of work to be done. And we need to find ways to engage millennials in the work that's happening. And Allie does a great job of kind of breaking some of that down for us.
It's really helpful. It's really helpful. I'm excited to listen.
I hope you enjoyed this conversation we had with Allie Hawkins, Millennials and Missions, from March of 2021.
We wanted to have Allie on because she was part of a very important research project that came out last year in 2020. And Andrew and I, in various circles, have been digesting and studying and just eating this research up because it's a very important topic, we believe, for the church. And the research is called The Future of Missions. And it was done by Barna in conjunction with the International Mission Board. And so we wanted to have Allie come on. So thank you, Allie, for joining us.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Yeah. And again, kind of twofold, because since this research project has been done, you have changed jobs. You've, I guess, bosses. You have changed jobs, but what's that?
Changed bosses.
Changed bosses. There you go. So you have changed bosses. You have moved from working for somebody to out on your own now. And so maybe just share a little bit about what it is that you do now. I know ghostwriting is part of that. So I'm not sure exactly. I mean, it kind of sounds very secretive and, you know, something I don't know if you can even talk about, but maybe just share with our audience what it is that you do. And if you're able to, give us some examples of some of your projects.
Sure. So I'm a freelance writer and editor. I've been working in editorial for, almost 20 years now, which is bananas. I worked in-house for a Christian publisher for a long time. And then I was out on my own as a freelancer, doing similar things, editing books. And then David Kinnaman, the president of Barna, right at a moment when he was beginning to ramp up Barnett has always, for a long time, couldn't figure out how to make the research, the very important research that they were doing, more accessible. You know, they would get hired by, let's say, a nonprofit, or, you know, whether it's missions organization or Sony Pictures or whatever, to find out, to do public opinion polling and help them understand what it means. But we were discovering all this really important stuff that could impact the church. And we wanted to be able to inform leaders, because information isn't everything, but it's pretty important. So yeah. David had this vision for packaging the research that we were doing with some of these other partners and making it more accessible to leaders in the church. And so kind of right at that moment, I was looking for a change. And so he hired me to figure out what that would look like. And so what ended up happening is we have these research reports in-house. They're called monographs, but they're basically somewhere between a book and a magazine, where we try to not dumb down the research, but be very intentional and focused about how we present it. Like choosing only the stories that matter to the reader. So instead of it being like an everything in the kitchen sink, this is every question that we asked and this is everything we found, Barna tries to be, in these monographs, tries to be very strategic about what does a pastor need to know. So that's what I did for about 6 years. Barna's still a client of mine. Love them. Just worked on the part two of the Gen Z study that just came out in, I think was just released like 3 weeks ago. So I wrote that as a freelancer. And then I have other clients. Barna's not my only client, but I have other clients that I would say that the theme that runs through it is, whether it's memoir or like whatever the genre is that I'm working in, it's about trying to keep the reader in mind. Like, who is this to? What is the message? How can we craft it in a way that is going to give the reader what they need?
You know, one of the things I think is important, I hate when people do this, when people connect you to your family,
you hate,
right?
What you hate what people do, and you're about ready to
do it right now. That's exactly right. But because we're talking to, you know, there's a lot of folks that are connected to the Church of God in this, I think it'd be important when they hear the last name Hawkins, like, let's connect you to the broader Church of God community. So your mom and dad, Jim and Marianne, were missionaries in the Church of God in Kenya for a number of years. Is that correct? I mean, that's kind of one of your connections into the Church of God world.
That is correct. Yes, we moved to Kenya when I was almost 15.
Wow.
And my brother was 12 or 13. Anyway, it was a minute ago, so I'm allowed to know it.
That's right.
Yeah, we became missionaries. My folks were Church of God pastors in Northeastern Oklahoma. And then when we were in our early teens, my brother and I, we moved overseas.
That's a huge shift for a teenager. I mean, that's...
It was 15, not a small shift. The first year was very hard.
Yeah.
Because neither one of you have been a 15-year-old girl, but take my word for it, being a 15-year-old girl is hard no matter where you are.
Yeah, right.
And then it shaped me in ways that it's hard for me to imagine being the person that I am without having had that experience. So I'm deeply, deeply grateful. And it was world-changing and life-changing experience. But yeah, it was not a small change.
It's not highly recommended by most missions agencies to send families with it. But when you're called, you know, you figure those things out. But I mean, that's a difficult time to be, especially a female, going to a new country at that age and being in a place where you probably didn't have a lot of necessarily people. I mean, Kima, where KIST is a smaller area. I mean, it's not like you're in a big city. Were you guys, did you board, or what was your experience?
Yeah, Tim and I went to Rift Valley Academy. Okay. So, you know, that was a change too.
Absolutely.
Living away from home, and we had gone to public school our whole lives. Wow. And so suddenly being in Christian school, like, that was we were kind of having our own experience of culture shock.
Yeah.
Of like intensive Jesus school, you know. You know, we had never had that experience before. Yeah. So yeah, it was crazy. And also, I think my parents were very smart in the way they handled it, which was they did not hand down the decree from on high. This is what we're doing. And God said it, so you can't argue with it. It was very much a family process, and we were all on board with it. So it was an adventure that we were having together, you know, and that doesn't ameliorate culture shock, right? Like the changes still happened, but I didn't feel like it was happening to me. Like it was being done to me. Yeah. And I think that made a big, big difference.
And my guess is that that experience probably shaped or at least helped in the research that you did with Barna talking about the future of missions. I mean, you had something to draw from. This wasn't just, it's not just numbers and research, but there was experience connected to your experience to draw on in that conversation.
Oh, for sure. When IMB, which is the missions arm of the Southern Baptist Convention, first came to Barna with this, you know, like, we want to find out what's going on. We think we're going to be in trouble if we don't understand what's going on. Even though I come from, you know, a very different background, Wesleyan and affirming women in ministry and all of those things, I was like, this is going to be my baby. I really wanted to work on this project for that very reason. I actually started at seminary at the SOT, at Anderson SOT, right before I got pregnant with my son. So that derailed things a little bit, but
just a little bit.
Yeah, it was, again, the big life changes.
Yeah, right.
Go big or go home, I guess. Yeah. But I was in the MAIS program, which is the intercultural studies program. Yeah. It's very, very important to me. Yeah. It's near and dear to my heart. So I, like, when this project came in, I wanted to work.
Yeah. That's awesome.
I was like, hello, this is going to be fun. So
I love that. And I can tell you, as someone who's gone through the research, read it, been in multiple discussion groups about it, it is, you described it as between a book and a magazine. It is. It's very approachable, and yet it's incredibly informative, the information there. And I want to jump into, we want to jump into some of that. So before we get exactly to the future of missions, I want to give a little bit of the background for those that this may be a brand new conversation. So our goal in this mini series, this theme, is to talk about millennials and missions. And, you know, one of your first writings you worked with David Kinnaman was, maybe not your first one you did with David Kinnaman, but the first one that I became aware of your writing was You Lost Me, which looks at the millennial, I think they call it the mosaics, but that context of those who are now the 18 to 34s that you look at, that overlap with some of the people in the future of missions. But can you tell us, before we jump into the future of missions, just some characteristics of millennials that might help us as we approach this research? You know, give us a little bit of a foundation before we get into how that then translates to the missions community.
Sure. I think it's important to qualify that generational science is not science. It is an art. And,
amen.
Yeah, there, you know, there are different theories. Every polling organization, whether it's Pew or PRRI or Barna, everybody kind of has their own cutoffs for the generations. The important thing, what we go back to, what Barna goes back to again and again, are the culturally shaping experiences that a collective group of people have as they're coming of age. So when I actually, in the first Gen Z study, the one that was released, I want to say in 2018, we talk about what a few of those shaping experiences are. So for boomers, it's post-World War II prosperity, the rise of the consumer economy, the sexual revolution, Vietnam War, the civil rights movement. Like, these were the collective, very powerful and culture-shaping events that unfolded as the boomers were coming of age. For Gen X, that would be me. It was the Challenger disaster, the end of the Cold War, no-fault divorce, the personal computer. Like, these shaped who we are. I would also say punk, but, you know, that was made just me. For millennials, 9/11 looms huge. 9/11 and the war on terror, obviously very formative, but maybe not even an event of that magnitude, probably not as large as the advent of the internet, yeah. mobile technology, globalization and diversity is huge. And the consumer mindset of their boomer parents, I think, is also a huge shaper of that generational identity. Yeah. So, and then Gen Z is just starting to come up. The Great Recession, I think, was very, very foundational for Gen Z. I think anxiety is an overarching theme among the youngest adult generation at this point. I feel like, you know, a lot of parents lost jobs and a lot of, you know, like it was a very, very impactful event that shaped their outlook on life. So when we talk about generational analysis, it's really talking about collective experience.
Yeah.
So millennials, young adults, are their digital natives. Gen Z, even more so than millennials. I mean, many in Gen Z are getting their first smartphones when they're, you know, 10, 11, whatever. Like,
it's crazy.
It's bananas. Yeah, I have opinions.
We like opinions. Opinions are good.
So
your travel and technology being really two huge factors when we talk about millennials. And I think that those things, even just those things alone, inform so much of the research that you've, I mean, the fact that millennials have traveled more than their parents tended to. And so their experience globally tends to be very different. But even if they don't travel, all they need is a phone to be able to talk to somebody from around the world. And so technology has created an opportunity to connect, whether those connections are real or whether those connections are robust and actually meaningful is another question, but they're at least an opportunity to engage through technology. So I think that absolutely speaks to them, kind of what this research begins to find.
That's absolutely true. I mean, the sheer amount of content that is available to people, the points of view that they can be exposed to. I mean, it was unimaginable when I was growing up. And I grew up in a family that was pretty culturally savvy and cared about, you know, other cultures and all of that stuff. But like, I couldn't text with a friend in Pakistan.
Right.
You know,
I saw a statistic a few years ago that every day, 60 years of footage is uploaded to YouTube. And this was a number of years ago, and 60 years worth. If you were to just in one day, if you were to put everything that was uploaded, it would amount to 60 years of watch. That information overload is, I mean, that's just immense.
It's no longer on a human scale.
No.
Which is, you know, getting into my opinions about like raising kids on technology and all that stuff. But yeah, it is no longer the fire hose of information that is spewed at us every day. It literally physiologically cannot be absorbed. Yeah. Like it is no longer at a humane or human scale.
Mm. Well, digging into some of this research, one of the first topics we wanted to talk about is in chapter 2, and where it picks up missions history and how that history shapes our present and our future. And there's basically what the research shows is that younger Christians are more likely than older Christians to express concern about the past, about the history of the church engaged in missions, whether that has to do with just overall reputation, things like colonialism. Mission work has been unethical in the past. That was one of the comments made. What, given that you have opinions, as you just stated, why do you think that is? What? And again, you can keep it to the research and then give some of your follow-up thoughts in terms of why you think that is. But I guess just to start off, why do you think that is, that difference between younger Christians and older Christians?
Well, I think the concern among younger Christians is just a slice of their concerns that are more broad about the past. So I think it's fair to say that in the last couple of years, a cultural reckoning with racism has begun.
Absolutely.
that is bigger and broader than what has happened in the past. Even though many people have been talking and thinking and trying to deal with racism, I think it is in our, the forefront of our cultural mind right now in a way that it has not been. And I think concern about missions is very much intersected with that.
Yeah.
So as post-colonial studies and critical race theory and like these sort of academic disciplines have trickled out into culture, we're more informed about the dark side of, I mean, I love capitalism. It has raised millions and millions and millions of people out of poverty. And also there's a dark side.
Yeah.
I love missions. It has brought the light of Christ to millions and millions of people. And also there's a dark side. So I think there is a willingness to grapple with the mixed legacy of the past. It's not all good and it's not all bad. But I think young adults in particular don't want to brush the bad under the carpet. They really want to wrestle with it and do better.
Yeah.
And as you're answering that question, the thought, you know, came to my mind in terms of, do you feel like younger generations are the younger generations? They're just not necessarily even more concerned about bringing these issues, these challenges into the conversation, but they're more willing to face these topics, I guess, head on than the older generations or previous generations, where maybe it's uncomfortable to have some of these conversations in some circles, where the younger generations, they want to wrestle, like you said, they want to wrestle with this and want to figure this out and ways to do it the right way versus just kind of sweeping it under the rug or forgetting about it. Does that make sense, what I'm asking or saying? Or
yeah, I think it's really important. I should have said this earlier, but I think it's really important to keep in mind the very strategic sample that we interviewed for this study. We interviewed engaged church-going Christians, people who already are predisposed to care about missions, to care about evangelism, to care about the mission of the church.
Yeah.
And I think, this is my opinion, but I think that the concern among young adults in this sample, these engaged Christians, is not just reflective of the culture, like the zeitgeist of the moment, which is, you know, like, let's tear down all the statues and all of that stuff. Like, I don't think it's just that. I think that... I think Barna has shown this over and over again, that millennials and Gen Z who are choosing to stay in the church are choosing to stay in the church because it's way too easy. It's really, really easy. There is no social pressure to be a church going Christian. And there is cultural reward for not, you know, and that is very, very different than in times past in the United States.
Absolutely. Which means that if this small subset of church going engaged Christians has a struggle with the past history of missions, we almost can assume that the broader general community might even have a higher,
Absolutely.
And I think one of the things we have to continue to wrestle with is that balance of expressing what is happening now and the opportunities that are happening on the ground, and being able, like you said, to hold in tension some of the challenges of the past. You know, there's a desire to see transparency and vulnerability on the part of organizations. I sense that, and we need to think about how, as an organization, how do we do that in a way that welcomes people into what God's calling us to in this moment, but also doesn't deny the fact that there may be a history that is difficult for us to reckon with, but we have to be willing to walk into that uncomfortable, that gray, that uncomfortability of that moment.
I think that's absolutely true. If organizations truly care about bringing the next generation into the conversation and imparting the urgency and passion for the Missio Dei, it's not a negotiable.
Yeah.
It's not.
You know, one of the things that is connected to that idea, I think, that was really fascinating to me is one of the findings from the research that I think was most interesting. I'd love for you to give some information, if you can, about how you came to this conclusion, how Barna came to this conclusion. But is that young Black Christians, 18 to 34, are less likely than the white majority to call missions very valuable. So they are less likely to call it valuable. They have more of a struggle with the history of missions than even the white community does. But they're more likely to be potential missionaries in the future. I thought that was so fascinating. And so can you talk to me about how the research points to that and what that should mean for us as organizations that are engaged in mission as we think to the future? That's a huge question.
I wish that there were one answer that I could give you the soundbite answer.
Come on, you're not going to fix it all for us? That's what we were hoping.
That's my 4 o'clock.
Yeah. Well, Andrew can edit this so it sounds like a one bite answer.
Yeah,
so
there we go.
Get it down. He can make you sound really good.
I think that obviously I do not speak for Black Christians in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah.
What we have found in the research is that the reckoning with past injustice is very much driven by ethnicity and self-identification as far as race is concerned. So unfortunately, it's much more important to Black Christians than it is to white Christians. Barna has been releasing quite a lot over the past couple of years, trying to understand what those roadblocks are, how pastors can guide and lead white Christians into repentance and reconciliation. But however that is, what the numbers say is that Black Christians care more about it and they believe it's a bigger deal.
Wow. Yeah.
And that goes even more for young Black Christians. I think colonial studies and post-colonialism as critique in literature and in history and, in all of the humanities is the norm now in academia. Yeah. Like that is how we're trying to understand the world. And so even how we study is reckoning with the past. It is very much a movement among academia, people of philosophy, just like the thinkers of our culture are like, oh, hey, we're a product. Like what we have now is a product of the past. We should probably try to understand what that means. And Black Christians are living that past more than white Christians are. There's bigger fallout. They have greater impacts in their everyday lives. And obviously these are gross generalizations, but I think that the numbers bear it out. So the white savior mentality of missions as it was done for a long time is a greater offense. You know, it hurts more when you can see the impact on your culture.
Yeah.
So the skepticism, I think, is pretty easy to understand. Well, not easy, but you know what I mean. It's pretty clear why their skepticism is manifest. As far as the wanting to be a potential missionary, to me, this is just like an incredible grace that I don't really understand.
Yeah.
And we went round and around about it. I interviewed, there are interviews in the study itself where I did long form interviews, trying to dig into it, trying to understand like why there would still be passion there. And like, I think it's grace, man. Yeah. I think God is calling people despite
absolutely
just like horribleness of humanity. And like when we have been at our worst, and yet God is not done. And as, like I said, these engaged church going Christians, the people who are in this study are here by choice, and they are spiritually disciplined. They're seeking God, they're praying, they're reading the word, they're going to church. And I think God's just like, yep, Awesome. So I'm going to call you guys and show you how it can be done differently. And thanks to forgiveness and reconciliation and openness, there are Christians of color answering that call. Yeah. Like, it's pretty awesome. Incredible.
So you brought up skepticism, and out of this research, there was a kind of a subgroup called the supportive skeptic, or that Barna labeled the supportive skeptic. And it was, this group is kind of described as those Christians who, as you've kind of mentioned, obviously they're engaged Christians, but they're also engaged in missions in some way. Maybe they've gone on short-term missions trips, or they financially support a missionary or missions in some way, or by some other means. Yet they have these reservations about the how and the why of missions and how missions is done globally. But yet Barna made the statement, or whoever wrote this made the statement, that they believe this group plays a role, an important role in the future of missions. Could you speak to that a little bit? Maybe you wrote that sentence about this group playing an important role.
Yes, I did.
Okay, perfect. Then we are talking awesome. To the right person.
That so is why my opinion.
So let's talk about your opinion. Why do you think the supportive skeptic group is an important role, or will play an important role in the future of missions?
I think they are skeptical because of their passion for the gospel. Mm. So I don't think their skepticism is coming from a place of wishy-washiness, or, you know, I'm just not sure about this Christian thing or whatever. I think it is deeply informed and coming from a place of real passion for reckoning with the past and living into mission into the future. So I think the reason they're so important is that they're sort of the distillation of the younger engaged Christians who are coming up, who maybe have some concerns, but they're not really sure what to express about it, or like they don't know why that it makes them uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. The supportive skeptics know why.
Yeah. They know why.
They have done a lot of thinking about it. They have done a lot of talking about it.
They know what questions to ask.
Yeah. Julian and Aaron Williams is a couple that I interviewed for the report. And I think they are just emblematic of this whole group. They came up in missions. They met on mission. They were formed doing short-term missions. I mean, like, it is so much a part of their identity, and they're just not sure about it anymore. Mm-hmm. Like, they still support missionaries, but as their theology has become richer, and as they have tried to understand the intersection of theology and politics, global politics and nationalism and all these other things, as they have asked these really tough and complex questions, what they've come away with is, we're not about short-term missions anymore. Like, we don't feel comfortable with that. And not every supportive skeptic is going to come to that place, and maybe they won't stay in that place. But the point is, as supportive skeptics, their position is very well thought through.
Yeah.
Mm. Where can supportive skeptics have these conversations, or where are they having these conversations, if at all?
I have no idea. I hope that they're having them in their church. I hope that that leaders, I said this earlier on when we were chatting about how this study came about, we really tried to be laser focused on making this a resource for leaders, church leaders in particular, who are passionate about missions and see that there is not that same passion in the next generation. And the Barna message to them is, unless you start having these tough conversations, it's going to stay that way.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. And I too have had some experiences with those in millennial generation, where maybe a young couple came off the mission field and were very disoriented about global missions in general, but about short-term missions, and to the point where they just felt like short-term missions should not be part of local ministry part of a ministry in a local church context. And so I feel like those conversations just aren't happening. Like those opinions are being formed through valid opinions are being formed through experiences, but there's no way for dialogue or conversation to take place. There's nobody willing to kind of talk about those because in some ways it very much confronts, I'm from the Generation X and, you know, it kind of confronts or conflicts with the way I've been brought up in church, or maybe the boomers have been brought up in church. And so,
yeah, well,
it, so know, it
when
feels very personable.
When missions is self-evidently good,
yeah,
mm-hmm.
then you don't have to have conversations about it,
yep.
you know, like when, so yeah, I mean, I think there is a generational disconnect there. I think I tend to think that Gen X in particular can be instrumental. We really are the bridge between the boomers and the millennials. And I think that we have not risen to our potential in that regard. So I hope that there are Gen X pastors who can recognize that, oh, okay, the assumption of the past was we own the gospel. We send people who own the gospel to spread it around the world. Like that was self-evidently good for a long time. Mm-hmm. And there are still people alive today in leadership today who are, you know, support churches and support missions and who, for whom that is still self-evidently true.
100%.
Yeah. So I think it's incumbent on leaders and particularly Gen X leaders to be the bridge to help have those conversations because it is not self-evidently good to the younger generation.
And churches have not been known to be places that really welcome doubt and question and, you know, those kinds of what I think are really valuable and important parts of our journey of faith, you know, to be able to ask questions and doubt. And so whether it's about anything, salvation, it doesn't matter. We can't allow someone to think that there is any part of us that questions whether something is right. And so missions has gotten lumped in, I think, with that whole, we can't question it because then everything breaks down rather than we've got to allow space for doubt and question and for us to wrestle with where we've been because God's calling us to somewhere in the future. And if we don't wrestle with our past, you know, we're never going to get there.
100%.
Can I ask you one more question as we wrap up? Because we're over our time, but one more question. What is something, if anything, that surprised you about this research? As you went through the data, as you dug into it, was there anything that for you, as someone who grew up as a part of a missions community, you think missiologically, where did you stop and go, wow, I am surprised that's what came out of this?
I think the openness and passion for mission, even though it is ill-defined and nebulous in expression, is hugely encouraging to me. And I don't think any of us expected to see, even though in the past 5 to 10 years of Barna research among the next generation, we have seen, again, those who stick around among the younger generation mean to be here. Like it's on purpose. They're not here because my parents, you know, like my family is Christian or whatever. Yeah. Like, that's just not a thing. So even beyond having that expectation, like knowing that the group that we were going to interview it are Christians on purpose, I don't think any of us were prepared for the openness and like readiness to get to work.
Which is encouraging.
It's hugely encouraging.
Yeah. It's but not it's over.
Also, it also, I think, should light a fire under leaders. Because that it is nebulous and ill-defined because of all these questions, because of the lack of reckoning with the past, like it can't, that openness and passion is not going to be directed toward mission without this work.
Yeah. It's not going to be directed towards the missions of 30 years ago. It's going to have to be something that speaks to where we are today and the things we know about that. You know, we have a responsibility now, not to be anachronistic and say that they should have known, but we have a responsibility now that we know how some of these systems created where we are today to make changes. And we have to be willing to do that. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, it, you know, one of the things I think that came out throughout the course of this study was the importance, the missionary, the current missionary on the field, the importance or the of the role that they played in shaping future or potential missionaries.
And, yes. Yes.
You know, that was one of the things that kind of stood out to me was the proximity that somebody had to a missionary on the field that very much swayed their perspective on missions and their own ability to get involved, potentially get involved in missions in some way as well.
Yeah. As we looked at, you know, as the data nerds did their thing with like regressions and all of that stuff that I barely understand, what pinged over and over again was personally having a relationship with a missionary makes you more likely to give to missions, makes you more likely to go on mission, makes you more likely to, to be involved in any capacity to consider long-term missions was a huge one. Like the more likely, if you know a missionary, you're much more likely to be like, yeah, I think I might want to spend my life overseas, you know, it is huge. And one of the things we talked about in the study was relationship is accountability. So the transparency, Andrew, that you were talking about earlier, like organizations really wrestling with how to be more wide open and, you know, like not make the sausage behind closed doors and all that stuff. Like that is relational. Yeah, we should publish all the financials and, you know, everything should be above board. But so much of that accountability is relational, because when people know and trust a person, they can believe in what they're doing.
Yeah. Wow. Well, Allie, thank you so much. Sorry,
my
Nate.
Pleasure.
Were you gonna say that? You were
I thought
say
you
that.
Wanted me to close.
I did, but you didn't yet. So I was gonna
I asked
do
another,
it.
I know. I asked another question, and I was in the middle of
I thought
typing
you were...
some notes based upon what Allie was just saying. So I was writing relationship is accountability. Okay. Allie, thank you so much for joining us. I feel like we could have spent another hour talking about this. In
easily,
fact,
yeah.
Hopefully we can have you back on sometime, just talking about missions, maybe this research project, maybe something else. But it's been so great to have you on. Thank you for your hard work in putting this research and this report together. I won't even ask you how many hours you spent on this project, but
no idea.
At least you got paid for it, right? You know, going back to something you said, it's convicting to me as a former missions pastor, as a missionary getting ready to go into the field. The thought or the idea of this, some of these conversations are not happening.
Yeah,
and that falls on my shoulders as just as much as anybody else's. You know, I'm a father of five kids, and two of my two oldest daughters, early 20s, are interested in missions, and they're moving to Spain with us. And so we've had a lot of these conversations, and I don't know that they are in the supportive skeptic category. They're probably close to that, but all that to say, they are asking the right questions, and I'm amazed at the depth of not just intelligence, but passion about missions and with that, not just missions, but doing, again, how we started this interview, doing missions in a healthy way, not in a harmful way. And that's at the end of the day, that's the important factor in all of this. And so thank you for this report. Thank you for this, you know, coming on here and talking about how can we do missions in a healthy way. It's such an important conversation that I hope our listeners, I hope that we continue the conversation.
Thank you so much. My pleasure.
Thanks for listening to A World of Good. A World of Good is a podcast production of Global Strategy and Church of God Ministries. Our theme song is Colorado by Leo Flores. If you want to join the conversation, visit us at Twitter at A World of Good Pod, on Instagram, A World of Good Podcast, or visit our website, chogglobal.org/A World of Good. And join us next time as we share more stories of good from around the world.